Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Tēnā koutou e te whānau. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Adam On, and today we are talking about a fantastic new book. It's called Blood and Dirt, Prison Labor and the Making of New Zealand. And we're talking to its author, Jared Davidson, who is an archivist by day and an author by night. I wonder if he gets time to watch Netflix. But he's with us today. Welcome, Jared.
Kia ora, Ed. Kia ora, tātou. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So I know we've talked about this part in our previous episode when I talked to you before. But generally, you have a specific way of looking at history and specific areas that you delve into, things that are unknown, not really talked about. So if you can tell our listeners that what angles do you take and what inspires you to go into those histories?
Sure. So I guess I'm a labor historian, broadly conceived. So I'm interested in working class history, working people's lives, and especially broadening the idea of class, thinking about how class and capitalism and state power operates within Aotearoa New Zealand, but kind of beyond the industrial male factory worker. So try and expand our understanding of working class lives. And so that's framed some of the topics of research in the past, such as the revolt of workers in Nelson in 1843, which we talked about last time, or, for example, a history of New Zealand anarchism, the industrial workers of the world, things like that. But I guess what frames my research is history from below and that kind of social history from the bottom up. So that's both having a sympathetic approach towards these workers on the margins, but also using it as a method. So thinking about how to do research, how to tell the narrative, how to place the reader into the lives and the shoes of these people I'm writing about. So yeah, it's kind of what I try and do. And I'm interested in topics and histories that maybe haven't been looked at too much depth, or things that have been looked at, but flip the script a little bit and bring class broadly conceived into the frame.
And also I've noticed in your work, you start at the one person, and then it goes on to a macro level, as compared to other histories, which kind of revolve around the macro level, and some stories of people are told in between. But you always base it on the people involved and tell their stories and connect them from the start to the end. Is that a conscious choice, or that has developed as a writing style through time as you've written more books?
No, it's a conscious choice for sure. I think it was Marcus Rediker, the historian, who said that you can tell a big story in a little story. And I wanted to get away from the idea of just using a nifty example at the start of a chapter and then moving on completely and you never hear from that person again. So it's about thinking about a life or a narrative that tells the bigger picture, but not necessarily then making that person or that story stand in for everything else. So it is quite conscious, and I guess it helps in terms of narrative nonfiction as well. So I'm really inspired by writers like Adam Hochschild, David Grann, people who are thinking as much about the story and the plot and how it reads as much as, say, the historical context that we're traversing too. So yeah, it is definitely conscious.
Yeah, it is a very interesting style, and it has made me more interested in reading more history and a couple of other writers from Pakistan that I've read recently. There's a book, 1971, which goes into the history of the partition of or the separation of Bangladesh from Pakistan, and it becomes like a people's history, and they. Those writers usually label it people's history, but you don't label it as such. But it is it is one of those that it springs from the people, and then the story of the nation or the era that you're talking about is told through their lens. Now, this topic that came in, when did the interest peak? Going into prisons. I mean, last time we talked about it, we were talking about Nelson and the workers' riots there. So, in the in between time, how does that interest change to prison labor?
Yeah, when I finished Dead Letters, I was interested in the idea of vagrancy. There was a couple of people who were labelled as idle and disorderly in that book, and I thought that's interesting, idle and disorderly. And so this book was going to be a history of vagrancy in Aotearoa, but then I realized that these so-called vagrants were being put to work to hard labor, often for short periods, but some longer periods. And I kept wondering what was the work they were doing in prison. And there are plenty of histories of prisons in Aotearoa, New Zealand, but the work that prisoners did is kind of skipped over mostly. And I think I had this kind of Hollywood perception of chain gangs in the quarry wearing stripes. Yeah, exactly. And to my surprise, looking into it further, prisoners did so much work outside of the jails within Aotearoa, New Zealand, and the wider Pacific. So that sort of became the lens. I was interested to look at what type of work prisoners were doing outside of the jails. And at the same time, I was learning more about abolition politics, learning more about the role of incarceration, and not just incarceration in a very narrow sense, but how those enclosures and the attack on idleness and kind of is infused throughout wider structures of power. So those all kind of came together, and I put the vagrancy book aside and focused on hard labor and the work that prisoners did outside of the jail.
Yeah, that would be a great book. Plus also somebody needs to write a book on Arthur Hume, but we'll talk about that as well. That's what I, when I started reading your book, I started imagining, when you go on the road and you're just driving around and then they have the stop and go sign. And I just imagine that people are either going on a horse cart or something, and somebody, you instead of looking at workers on the right and the diggers working, they might be chain gangs and they will be prisoners that you just walk through and pass through while they are working on the side, maybe singing a song or just going through. And then people with guns kind of hanging out with them. So it's quite a movie style vision. So in terms of the terms, right, if you can define or just elaborate on what is unfree labor and what is free labor, and then obviously waged we would know, but and then what is forced labor?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I guess within Marxist or even social labor historiography, types of work regimes are often framed in terms of free and unfree. Free being the idea that you and I go off to work and earn a wage and we're free to sell our labor that way. And unfree being the opposite end, something like slavery, perhaps, being the opposite extreme. And so one of the things that I wanted to do in the book, and this is following a lot of other scholarship as well, is to try and break down that free, unfree binary. Because as historians and Marxists have told us, actually, both free and unfree labour are framed by degrees of coercion. You and I don't get up to work and go off and earn a wage because we want to necessarily. Mm. There's different coercions at play, and the same with unfree labour. And what I found studying this book, especially in the 19th century for men, that free, unfree labour divide was really porous. You had a working class chap on a navvy gang or a farmhand or working in town who could go into jail for drunkenness and then come out and get a job doing the very same type of work the very next day. So one of the arguments of the book is that we need to look at these as kind of continuums of coercion rather than necessarily free and unfree. That's not to dismiss the particular institution that slavery was. I don't want to dismiss that as well, but thinking about the Aotearoa New Zealand context, especially in the 19th century, trying to complicate that idea of free and unfree binaries. And like you said, that vision of unfree workers on the side of the road, that was a vision that would have been normal in the New Zealand landscape for a lot of people. And in Wellington, chain gangs marched down from the terrorist jail to the brickworks at Pukeahu right up until 1915. So it was a common thing to see within Aotearoa New Zealand, yet it's not the type of image we associate with kind of New Zealand and the colonial kind of story that's told.
Yeah, and it is interesting to see the crime that people were paying their debt off from. Like, for instance, the idleness and vagrancy. It is very interesting to me because in a modern context, that is not considered or even thought about. While at that time, idleness was considered a crime, or things that might lead from idleness might be considered a crime. And it turns out that a huge percentage of people were in jail because of that. It's like comparing from nowadays, people might be in jail for smoking pot. That kind of comparison. So do you think that it had a religious or a economic, a capitalist connotation of just hanging about, that means it's a crime, you're not productive enough?
Yeah, for sure. So you're totally right. So idleness or vagrancy for most of the 19th century was the second highest crime for men, at least, behind drunkenness. And in the 1870s, vagrancy and idle and disorderly charges were used very broadly against a whole lot of working class people, including women, prostitution in particular. So it was this kind of catch-all social economy type charge. And in Aotearoa, New Zealand, one of the things was that there was a shortage of labour, and it seemed that to be idle, both outside of the jail and in the jail, was more criminal than crime itself. And that's one of the reasons why so much work, public infrastructure, was done by prisoners, because it was like, why would we leave all this untapped labour behind a hastily erected fence? Why don't we put them to work? And that was different to the UK, and something that was quite unique about Aotearoa New Zealand. So yeah, that idea of idleness, and the inverse of that is improvement, right? So the original meaning of improvement from the 16th century, from the birth of capitalism in the UK at least, is the idea that you enclose land and you turn land to make a profit. That's the original meaning of improvement. And it seemed to me this was really clear link from Samuel Marsden arriving in Aotearoa in 1814, wanting to improve, so-called improve Māori society, right through to idle labour power and idle landscapes in the New Zealand context being in need of improvement. So yeah, idleness and improvement become quite a strong framing throughout the book, and that's how I set up a lot of the chapters as well, going from chapter 1 on Samuel Marsden and the Irish convicts right through to chapter 7 on prison land.
So I would really love for you. People should read the book, and it's beautifully laid out in the first chapter. But I would like to talk about, or for you to elaborate a little bit. This, you can say, it's not a, for the lack of a better word, it's not a pioneering story, but it is, in the sense, a kickstart to prison. Because in regular understanding of history, and my understanding of history as well, was like Samuel Marsden came and he set up shop here, and it was the start of the missionary work. Now, if you go under the layer, who was with him and what they did, so the in general imagination, people think that there were other devotees that might have come with him and would have worked together in a community, in a communal thing. But if you can point out what actually happened and how people who were helping or forced by Thomas Kendall, Samuel Marsden, to work on the site at Hohe.
Yeah, sure. So in 1814, one of the first mission stations in the South Pacific, and especially in Aotearoa, is set up by Samuel Marsden and a number of missionary families, including Thomas Kendall. But they also bring convict laborers with them, many of them who had been transported to Sydney. Some of them Irish convicts, such as Matthew Conroy, was involved in the 1798 rebellion against the English. So there's a thread there of kind of radicalism and then convict labor. And so these convicts are put to work at Hohe Mission Station. One of the blacksmiths, Walter Hall, is a convict, and it's his tomahawks, it's his metalwork that he makes that actually pays for the land at Rangihaua, the Hohe Mission. Mm. And one of the arguments of the book, and something that surprised me as well, was that not only were convicts brought over with Marsden and Kendall and others to produce the tools and do the labor at the mission, they also became a jail. Hohe became Aotearoa's first jail by holding in chains runaway convicts, desertees from passing ships, and they were kind of held in the Hohe Mission and used for their labor. And that's because Thomas Kendall was one of the first magistrates. So yeah, there's not only the convicts that came with Marsden, there's convicts being left in the settlement to do work before they're shipped back to Sydney to be charged for absconding. So that was really interesting to me, because I think the story is that, you know, with 1840 and the Te Tiriti o Waitangi jails get set up, or it's this big old sea chest in Kororarika that's the first prison. But if we look at the nature of houses of corrections and prisons in the early 19th century, then Hohe Mission Station, in my view, is our earliest example.
Yeah, it does make sense as well. And do you think there was some reasoning behind not making New Zealand? Because it seems like perfect. It's like an island. A bunch of islands, like Australia as well, big on continent. Why not make New Zealand a convict colony?
Well, the Colonial Office in the UK did actually think about Aotearoa New Zealand as the convict penal colony to replace the Americas. But Australia kind of won out in the end, and partly because New Zealand and its rich resources of flax and things, timber, was nearby. They thought it would be able to kind of service the colony of Sydney. And that kind of shapes the direction of prison labour in Aotearoa New Zealand, because when Lieutenant Governor William Hobson wants to come to New Zealand and sign this treaty with Māori, he is really dismayed at the idea of trying to do public work without convicts. He wants to bring a gang of convicts from Sydney with him, but the Colonial Office kind of refused. And so that sets up the shape of prison labour to come, because instead of being able to import convicts from afar, the colonial state decides to put the prisoners they have up to hand to work. And they end up doing so much key infrastructure. And this is really surprising to me. But and the book's set up around these workscapes, as I kind of frame them. And, and you know, that includes roads, public works, military fortifications, clearing,
harbors, banks. Harbors,
yeah, so much stuff.
Just buildings, everything.
Yeah, so much stuff. And that was really, really eye-opening to me. And so, yeah, as I said, the book kind of traverses those work regimes from the bottom up and through to kind of 1920s, 1930s, because by the time the 20th century kind of kicks in, a lot of the work regimes of the 20th century are in place by the 1920s and 30s. And plus, I had to stop somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Too big otherwise.
Maybe a part two. So, so what are Tangata Whenua thinking at that time? What are Maori thinking at that time? And I mean, obviously, it's laid out in the book, but I really admire your work when you do the, you know, when you go into the letters, and Thomas Kendall's letters show how were Maori feeling at that time. So can you elaborate on at Hoi at that time, at the inception of the first prison or the prison labor work ethic, what were Maori thinking?
Yeah, there's a quote in one of the letters that you referenced where Paul Murray, one of the rangatira in the kind of Bay of Islands area, is reduced to tears by seeing these deserters or runaway convicts in chains and being ready to be sent back to Sydney. So foreign was the idea of confining someone like that. And in chapter four, I kind of follow that through, because that's the chapter on, I call it war. It's on the link between unfree labor and militarism. And unfortunately, you know, some of Paul Māori's kin end up in chains during the Northern War, and then that story of Māori imprisonment kind of through war captivity is told in that chapter. And what's interesting as well, and something I didn't necessarily know, was that the prison population in terms of Māori was minuscule during the 19th century, apart from some key moments associated with the New Zealand Wars and other conflicts. And it wasn't really till the 20th century, post the massive enclosure, millions and millions of acres of land taken by the Liberal government for closer settlement and dairy farming, that you start to see prison...
Seddon's time.
Yep, that's right. Seddon's sort of 1890s onward. And you start to see Māori prisoners and the rate of imprisonment increasing. But yeah, the tangata whenua, obviously I'm not a Māori scholar, and these stories I can't necessarily tell, but in that chapter I do look at the Waikato Wars. I do look at some of the prisoners from Taranaki, the Pai Marae prisoners who are kind of imprisoned on hulks and then later put to work in places like Dunedin and Littleton and Hokitika. So it's definitely there. And then in the last chapter as well, I do come around back to kind of Marsden's vision of improvement and use that to tell the story of prison lands and prison farms.
Yes, and it's also the aim of imprisonment of Maori changes. The aim of general imprisonment, you know, starting from vagrancy and other crimes, and then putting people to work in prison labor, but with Maori, it turns more towards more colonial aspects of it, in terms of confiscations of land, and then the crimes that are categorized as crimes against property, and then it starts to increase, and obviously there's certain cases. You mentioned also in Taranaki and Parihaka, people are taken prisoners and put in prisons for a long period of time without any trial or any of the regular justice avenues that were available to Pākehā at that time. One question I had, it just popped in my head before I forget, In the pictures I've seen, people have their hands, the prisoners would have their hands laid out. You can say it's their mugshot. What's the purpose around that?
Yeah, so, you know, before fingerprinting, but with the birth and use of photography by the state to surveil, the use of hands across your chest was basically to show any identifying features of that person. And then they were published in publications like the New Zealand Police Gazette and circulated around police stations. So, I mean, that's a good segue into both photography and sources, because one of the things I found with the book was that there's very little photographic evidence of chain gangs at work. One of the reasons was that it was illegal to loiter near a chain gang. So photographers weren't allowed to get close. In the 19th century, as again, to come back to that kind of porous nature, sometimes it was pretty unruly, the chain gang. So you had working class people who were sympathetic to prisoners at work who would smuggle them smokes or alcohol or end up scrapping with the warder if they got too close. The flip side of that is... you start to get a lot of sources about prisoners in terms of the Police Gazette, confinement. You know, they were surveilled and managed by the state. The problem is you don't necessarily have the prisoner's own voice in those records. So for a historian of below, you really need to kind of either read the archives differently or look for sources such as petitions to the government for an early release, to try and get a sense of how prisoners experienced those work regimes. But yeah, essentially that's the hands across the chest so the state can tell who this person is.
And then one interesting thing I found was the mark sheet, like an exam, you know, reward and punishment. That was I mean, it's not a good thing, but it was quite exciting to see that level of inner workings of a prison, so how one person has been good and how have they been bad. And was it a common practice on assessing prisons on the day-to-day activity as well, or it was just that one example that you had presented in the book?
Yeah, I mean, the thing to know for listeners overseas is that Aotearoa New Zealand had provincial governments. So regions had their own governments, which were kind of within a wider central government. And so between the 1850s, 1853 and 1876, provincial governments had control of the prisons and control of the work regimes. So you get quite a hodgepodge cases of how prisoners are managed and measured. And so some... prisons instituted this mark system, as you said. And depending on the type of work you did as a prisoner, you'd get a certain amount of marks, and that might move you up the scale to an earlier release or a different uniform or badge. Or if you played up, if you were unruly or idle, then you'd move down the mark system. But a lot of jails realized that on a chain gang, when work is so collective in nature, it was almost near impossible to measure people properly. And there's this tension within Aotearoa New Zealand's prison history about whether they're doing the separate system where prisoners are confined and they basically, in solitary rehabilitation, they come right, or whether you're doing the silent system where you march them out to work. They're not allowed to talk to each other. And that's the kind of what ends up happening in Aotearoa New Zealand. But yeah, so the mark system kind of comes and goes, and at one stage they realize it's too unwieldy to actually measure people. But some provincial governments like Otago were really big on measuring both the work that gangs did and reporting on that, and then also reporting the monetary kind of savings.
So right.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting.
It's... one thing you just mentioned, and it has sprung up an idea in my head about prisoners unionizing in an informal way or a formal way. That was a quite an intriguing thing to read, because in the current system, those are those opportunities you can't see for the prisoners, and usually there is a mutiny and people escape, and you can see it in the youth justice system as well here in modern times. But what were the opportunities, and what kind of paved the way for the prisoners to take collective action?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And one of the things I really wanted to do with this book was to treat prisoners as a working class formation. Mm. So it seemed to me that New Zealand labour historians hadn't looked past the prison walls. It was like there's plenty of studies of different types of workers in 19th century New Zealand, you know, different crews, different gangs, but not prisoners as a working class formation. So that was a really key point of the book, and that meant I guess I could look at prisoner resistance and strikes and mutinies in that sense. And you know, there were opportunities to plot and talk on the chain gang out in the works. Prisoners escaped individually or collectively as a kind of protest from their work, but there were strikes and mutinies, such as quite a big mutiny on board the prison hulks here in Esther, what was used to basically build all of the roads around Otago Harbour. And I think one of the prison reports said something like, there was a brief disturbance, but everything worked out fine. And when you see things like that in an official report, you know something's up. And so I found the archives on that, that basically a prisoner had was unwell and didn't want to be put to work that day. And he was kind of bundled out of bed by the authorities. And so the rest of the prisoners struck work and refused to come up out of the hulk. They ended up doing things like smearing food through their jailers' beds and stuff like that. And the ringleaders get sent off. And what I also found, which was interesting to me, is that labour historians have kind of talked about New Zealand in the 1890s as a working man's paradise, that there were no strikes, and that it wasn't till kind of 1906, 1907, and the rise of the workers, radical workers' movement, that strikes start to happen again. But prisoners on these various pine plantations are striking. 1903, 1904, the sabotaging tools and the planting of pine trees, and often winning, you know, different conditions of labor and time about when they finish work and start work for the day. So that was really interesting to me to see that prisoners were kind of drawing upon methods and modes of resistance in the wider world. And I think that comes back to that unfree, free binary, or the false nature of that binary.
And also, I think, I suppose by that time, it might have happened, but the fortification of the boundaries of the prisons hadn't happened too much by that time, because at that time we needed the labor. And in the book, it is interestingly, you've mentioned in several places where different parties were arguing about why can't we get this labor, or we should do this project through prison labor rather than spending our own money. So it was an economic unit or economic factor in the country's development. Prison labor was huge, whereas now it's more towards confinement. But at that time, it was a tool used by the colonial government to essentially build New Zealand.
Yeah, that's a key argument of my book, Ed, is that prison labor was crucial to colonization, both in Aotearoa and also in New Zealand's Pacific. So one of the chapters called Empire, I really wanted to pick up the challenge of Indigenous scholars, Pacific Islanders scholars, who remind us that New Zealand had a role in the Pacific and that the Pacific is part of Aotearoa. So one of the chapters does focus on the Cook Islands, Niue, Samoa, and a little bit of Nauru and Banaba, the kind of big phosphate producing islands.
You tell those that story beautifully. People need to go and read. It kind of starts and then it connects in the end. I spoil it for the people.
Yeah. That was actually one of the first chapters I wrote because I'm not a historian of the Pacific or an expert by far. So I wanted to make sure I got it right. So thanks. But yeah, there's resonances with the rest of the history there as well, especially how I said at the start of this interview that New Zealand didn't import convicts, but actually in the 1920s, Pacific Islanders were sent from the Pacific to Aotearoa New Zealand as punishment. So in those cases, we did have convicts coming from afar to work in Aotearoa.
We're talking about empire. In the Pacific Islands, there was a slight difference in terms of the creation of the penitentiary system or the prison system. It's not exactly penitentiary system because it became the system of the land, and there was a huge part Christianity played in there as well. So can you elaborate a little bit more on that and what were the differences, even though it was essentially quite similar, but what were the differences? Because it seemed more harsh and more, you can say, as a tool, right on the side of the army, you will attack and you will conquer a place, but prisons will be actually one of the tools that you would use.
Especially in the Cook Islands and Samoa, both prisons and prison labor were used pretty much immediately. So that was on the back of missionaries starting to basically attack the kind of sexual mores and cultural processes within the islands. You know, they were horrified by this idea of kind of Pacific Island communism where things were shared and property was not individualized. And so prisons and prison labor was quite different in the Pacific, but it had the same means of improvement. Some of the main work that prisoners did in the Pacific, especially in the Cook Islands, were building roads, doing that harbor work as well, but also plantation work. So the Cook Islands trading company had a plantation on the island of Manua, and that was where a lot of habitual offenders were sent by the colonial powers. And it was one of the most highest producing copra plantations in the Pacific at that time. So there's, links to that as well in terms of improvement, idleness. And they weren't necessarily the big prisons that we associate with New Zealand and walls. Sometimes in the early part of Rarotonga's history, prisoners could go back home at night and then come out and do their charge the next day. But essentially that worked for empire because it meant it was cheaper and it could also do that improvement. Empire on the cheap is what I talk about.
Yeah. And the chapter also kind of lays down the history around the indentured labor that starts to come in from China. But the conditions were kind of still similar. So how would you say the indentured labor was similar or different from prison labor, especially in the context of empire in the Pacific?
Yeah, I mean, that again goes back to that question of the binary of free and unfree and whether that's useful or not. And I think in some circumstances it definitely is. But in Samoa, for example, and in Nauru and Banaba, you had Chinese on indentured contracts. So basically contracts of 3 years usually to work for a specific time for a planter or for a company. And if those Chinese laborers and Pacific Islanders in some cases, if they played up, then they were put to work in the prison. And some of those work regimes were exactly the same as what they were already doing under the indentured contract. In fact, if you look at the photographs, and there's a photograph in the book of the Chinese quarters in Nauru, they're all surrounded by barbed wire fences, which I found very interesting. And those gates could be locked whenever there was kind of worker unrest. So there are definitely differences, don't get me wrong, but I think it's more useful to see these work regimes on a continuum of coercion. And that's kind of, that's riffing off a whole lot of other historians who have explored that, but that kind of frames Blood and Dirt and the labor regimes I cover.
It is, the reasons behind indenture labor, usually my understanding or my reading of history is more related to the Indian indentured labor going to the Pacific as well, which is Fiji, and also then going to Central America, Caribbean. The reasons usually were there, it was kind of like bonded labor type situation that you were paying off your debts. So was it similar in this case as well?
Right? Yeah, in the Cook Islands especially, prisoners or those who were convicted of a crime were often fined in the first instance. And sometimes the colonial regimes, because each island had their own kind of administrator, so it was quite decentralized in terms of the work prisoners did. But in some cases, they preferred the fines, they preferred the money. And in other cases, they preferred the labor, or those people who were convicted didn't have the money to pay off the fines. So there's that sense of bondage there. If you can't pay this fine, you will go to work on the plantation, or you will go to work making these roads, or you will blast the coral reef open for commercial trade. So yeah, there's an element there as well.
Talking about plantations, but we'll talk about a different type of plantation, the ones that prisons kind of built in New Zealand. Now, people might have an understanding of tree planting activity as a nice outing, and you go and plant some trees and that's it. But it was quite starkly different from the regular tree planting activity that you do on a school trip. It was quite revealing to me that they were essentially sometimes more horrendous conditions than just building a road or building a harbor. Plantations of trees was one of the worst ways people were employed in unfree labor.
Yeah, so from 1901 onwards, prisons were set up in remote parts of the country to plant trees, basically. There was the state feared a timber shortage and thought, why not put prisoners to work? So the first one was in Waiotapu, which is around the Central Plateau near Rotorua, and that becomes Kaiangaroa Forest, which then becomes the Crown's jewel in terms of its multi-billion dollar pine asset. And there were other pine plantations in Hamner Springs, Dumgree and Marlborough, and various places around the Central Plateau. And before prisoners were marched out and to do this planting work, they were essentially tussocky scrubland. So there were no forests in Hamner or Kaiangaroa, which is, you know, if you drive past today, it's just like it's always been there. But the conditions could be horrendous, freezing cold frosts, bitter winds, pine trees scratching at eyeballs, losing fingers and thumbs. And Waiotapu, what was interesting about that landscape was that it had thermal areas. And so the state actually took those areas from Māori and then turned them into tourist ventures. But because of the thermal...
And it was essentially more like a mixture of confiscation, shoddy deals, and obviously Ministry of Works, that type of ways, that usual ways that were done to confiscate Maori land, correct?
Yeah, there's a number of laws around that time for the kind of scenic or preservation of scenery, and they were used in that area. But it meant that prisoners were basically planting trees around bubbling mud pools and steam vents and all sorts of things. So that idea of workscapes from Thomas G. Andrews and other historians really helped me frame the book. And one of the things I wanted to do was to convey that this wasn't just a labor history, it was an environmental history. The more I realized that I was writing about prisoners in the landscape, the more I realized there was a story here about how prisoners transformed space, but were also transformed in turn. So that was kind of a new approach for me, and trying to go, you know, history from the bottom up, right from the land itself.
Yeah, and it essentially changed the environment, essentially the basis of the forestry in New Zealand was kind of changed through prison labor. Other people worked on it as well, but it is a major factor in that. Now, I mean, I've heard your other interviews as well around it. So you've talked a lot about different places around the country which are done, which are built by prisoners. So I would not go into too many details of that, but a couple of places where you were quite amazed and realized that, oh my goodness, it just exists in front of me and I never knew.
Yeah. I mean, the forestry ones for sure. Like, when I was a kid, I grew up in Christchurch, and every so often would go to Hamner Springs, and I used to sit in a field.
I was so amazed when I this whole story about Hamner Springs. I was like, oh my god!
It's for those who don't know Hamner Springs. It's kind of like an alpine resort now. It's this kind of walking and cycling paradise through the forest that was in part raised by prisoners. But yeah, I used to draw that forest with my dad as a 9-year-old, and had no idea. And then the forestry in Kaiangaroa, when you drive through the central plateau, it's just lines and lines of pine trees which have roots in prison labor. The other one that really surprised me were the first highways through the central plateau. So prisoners basically were the first people to complete the road joining Wellington to Auckland, on the Waikune side of Mount Uruapehu. So before that time, it was all main trunk line railway. And so prisoners from these road camps made the first highways through the central plateau, and then for decades upkept about 130 kilometres of highway. And so there's a linked tourism there in terms of getting skiers and tourists up Mount Uruapehu. Milford Sound Prison, if we're talking about tourism, Milford Sound Prison was established in 1890 to turn a rudimentary track through the Milford Sound into a road. And it didn't happen because of the weather and unrest and other reasons. But
that's a great story, actually, in the book. Yeah,
anyone who's walked the Milford Sound track finishes their walk at Sandfly Point and on the kind of sculpted track that prisoners did. But, I mean, one of the biggest places that really surprised me was Lyttelton. Lyttelton was a place that I used to visit, or in my teenage years, I was, university years, I played in bands there. And so much of Port Lyttelton, its roads, its seawall, its harbour, its piers, its embankments were made by prisoners marched out of the Lyttelton jail, not to mention all of the military fortifications on Repapa Island and all around that harbour. So that was really surprising to me as well. But I hope, Ed, that the book does make people think differently about the kind of spaces we take for granted, and maybe look at Aotearoa New Zealand in a new light.
And also for listeners, I would say that it is essential to get because the book is kind of laid out in different sections, but the story connects. So the story is about how industry was set up in New Zealand, how prison labor was involved in war, empire and colonization. So all these are laid out beautifully in chapters, and also the conclusion is fantastic as well. Well, now we're talking about the conclusions. I would see. So what do you see in terms of the lessons for the future? Because nowadays there is a great chatter around the essentiality of prisons, or uselessness of prisons, and how important is this history of unfree labor connected to incarceration? How important is it so that we can find a future where prison is not a tool of incarcerating Tangata Whenua, and also not a tool of just confining people? I found it quite a reflective book reading this history. What do you see?
Yeah, I think I see now, having done this research, how implicated prisons and incarceration are throughout social relations of capitalism and colonization. They can't be separated or hived off, even though, you know, prisons these days are hived off and kind of out of sight. Both in the 19th century and arguably today, prisons play such an important role in terms of, yeah, whether that's kind of managing surplus populations, whether it's colonization, whether it's kind of a geographical response, whether it's a tool of mobilizing people so that they do certain things or don't do certain things. That for me was a real eye-opener. And in terms of the future, I think if this book is of any use to people thinking about abolition and different ways of addressing harm, then yeah, I'd be very pleased if Blood and Dirt kind of adds to that conversation. I don't necessarily have the answers, I'm still learning that too, but yeah, I think if this book lends itself to conversations about abolitionist futures, then yeah, I'd be very happy.
Very nice. So now, Blood and Dirt, the title, we should have talked about it right at the top. But in any case, I wanted to talk about that. And also, you kind of very nicely just put your positionality right at the top, that where are you coming from? It's not like a regular historian who comes from a neutral point and just lays out all the resources and that's it. So what kind of motivated you to do that, and where did the name come from?
Yeah, so Blood and Dirt is famously a quote from Marx. You know, he says that capital comes dripping from head to foot with blood and dirt. And it also framed the story, I realized, because here was blood in terms of human prison labor and sometimes extra human, and then dirt being that environmental aspect of it, and that idea of idleness and improvement and waste linked both together. And yeah, I'm not one of those historians who claim to be neutral. I think anyone researching and writing stands by, or doesn't stand by, their choices and their approaches. Everything we do is political, whether we acknowledge it or not. But yeah, Blood and Dirt, I really wanted to kind of approach from a radical history bent and look at some of the kind of deeper causes and the social relations beyond just the surface of appearances. And that's where that Blood and Dirt comes back as well. So yeah, that's not everyone's asked me about that, interestingly. Maybe it's too obvious, but yeah, it became a kind of way to frame both the story and the approach.
I wanted to talk about Arthur Hume, but you know, I think maybe it's a future book by you, but I don't think you're writing biographies. Well, maybe later in life, but that seemed to be he seemed to be a interesting character, and also several concepts that might come out of this this book, which would lead to other academics or historians to work on deeper. Now, what's next? What's happening? Well, are you just hanging out, taking a break, watching some TV, on to the next one?
I've got a few different ideas on where to go next, and I can't quite land on one, so I need to hurry up make it.
It's the whiteboard stage at the moment.
One is kind of looking at a period between the Hohe Mission and 1840 around runaway convicts. I think there's something to be said there. And then there's
that would be intense archival work.
Yeah. And then there's the Idle and Disorderly Vagrancy book. I think Policing Idleness is a story there. But I am interested in bringing nature, so-called nature and the environment, into capitalism a bit more. And so there's some stories and threads from Blood and Dirt that I'd like to further as well. So, yeah, I just need to land on one of those and find some time.
Yes, it will be great. I'll be looking forward to it, and hopefully we'll have another interview. People can find you at jared-davidson.com.
Yes, that's the website. Yeah.
So there's all the other works are presented there. You can check it out. But this book is Blood and Dirt, Prison Labor, and the Making of New Zealand. It's available through it's available everywhere, all bookshops, but published by Bridget Williams Books. It's fantastic. Get your hands on it. And thank you, Jared. Thank you for having this extensive conversation. It was enlightening. And it really helped elaborate on many of the things that were there in the book. So, yeah, have a fantastic week, day, month, year, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Thanks, Ed. Appreciate it.